Time, weather, and...
Always!
Welcome to the Jay and Pav Podcast Experience.
You're listening to The Che and Pav Show, Teachers Talking Teaching.
Where two middle school teachers sharing our reflections, insights about the topics that matter the most in the classroom. So hey, Pav, join us in the hallway or even the parking lot, or better yet, how about the staff room?
Welcome to episode 119 of the Che and Pav Show. Thank you for joining us as we sit around the table to talk teaching. In this episode, we will have a conversation about performative social justice work. Yes, you heard me right. Can our performative actions be a positive gateway to doing the work? I'm interested to see where this one goes. But before we can get into the content, we have a few things that we need to check off our list. Get it? Check off our list. I'll start by introducing myself. My name is Pav Wander, and I'm half of the hosting team of the Che and Pav Show. My co-host likes to introduce himself through comedy, so let's humor him and give him his 5 minutes of fame.
Since when did you become so funny to start the episodes? Because Pav's a brick house. And Che's the shed in the back corner that we keep the lawnmowers in that we never discard. And they're just an accumulation of more and more lawnmowers and bits and pieces. And that's where you'll find me.
Hi, Che.
And when you said Chekhov, I immediately almost went into Captain Kirk mode.
Mm.
But you've thrown me off because you usually don't try to be funny. And then it threw me off because I've actually found you funny, and we know that you can check that off the list. I have a problem with the fact that I find nobody funny.
Right, but we've already covered this. You do find me funny, and I have made it my life's work to make you laugh.
Three times.
And when I succeed, it brings me so much joy. And so I can tell by the look on your face that you actually found me funny today. And so there, that's it. It's done. I checked it off my list. Good night, everybody. I hope you enjoyed the show.
I've been totally, you know, flustered. Not the first time this month.
No.
Pav, thanks for that wonderful introduction.
I like your giggles. They're fun.
Who am I recording this podcast episode with? Who is taking over here? You are the foundation of these episodes. I'm the one that weaves in and around the straight path you're taking us on. And now you are all over the place. I'm like, does this change my responsibility by making me having to become more responsible? Because that's not really the role I can do in this dynamic.
Like, I don't know. I guess I'm just in a giddy mood tonight.
When I say we have a great webpage, I really mean Pav puts together a great webpage.
Yeah.
I just look at it and Pav goes, make me some art for this.
Yes.
And then you create this.
That's essential. That's essential. I couldn't do it without the artwork. Like, I do the minion work. You have the creative edge in everything that we do. So let's remember how this team works.
I'm letting that sink in. Mm-hmm. Che has the creative edge. Actually, I'm going to jot this down on my notes because I'll forget it. But then I don't need to jot it down on my notes because we're recording it, so I can just go and listen to it back.
Yeah.
Pav, we took some really important data recently about the start of our episodes and whether banter was crucial.
Yeah.
And although I said we took some data, I really wasn't looking for data and I didn't care what the data was. We were going to keep the banter going anyways.
Absolutely.
But it was wonderful to hear Holly and Josie jump in right away about the value of the banter. And it actually reminded me of Ralph Nader, a podcast we listened to, when he was talking about the power of radio over podcast, mm-hmm. that there is a distinct difference. And radio tends to be locally driven, and you build community relationships.
Yes.
You build that relationship with your audience. And a podcast, there's still a relationship, but it's not the same. Yeah. And so the banter becomes a space to maybe try to create that local radio show energy to feel like you're here. And if you are listening right now, you can come over right away. There's two empty chairs here in mm-hmm. our studio. Mm-hmm. And of course, we often joke, we just record in the kitchen, but it's not a joke.
Yeah.
We record in the kitchen.
We actually, that's where we record. That's where we can yeah. only record.
I got the deep fryer going right now.
It's an air fryer. It's not a deep fryer.
The things are fried, right?
It's air fried. So it's like a convection oven. It's not really frying.
So they're super fried.
You keep calling it a deep fryer. I do not have a deep fryer. It's an air fryer. And it works gloriously. Everything that you eat.
The oven in this kitchen has not been turned on in 7 years.
I have not turned on my oven since I got my air fryer. It's magic. It's magic. Everybody, confirm it, please.
I'll make this a commercial later on. We are sponsored by air fryers. Let me, while you talk, I'm going to turn around and look and see what the brand is.
don't say it on air.
Why? We could cash in. Maybe they'll start sending us 3 or 4 of these. We could give them away on social media.
Christmas is coming up. That is true.
And Jay and Pav, what are they called now? Air fryers?
Air fryers.
This doesn't have the same je ne sais quoi when it goes off the tongue. Air fryer.
Yeah.
Deep fryer.
No.
Air. Deep.
Okay.
Air.
Sure.
Deep. Undercover. Reminds me of Eddie Murphy and Beverly Hills Cop 2.
It's a Ninja, by the way. I got it from Costco and it's magnificent. It was my 40th birthday present from my mom.
Why do you lie?
What? That's not a lie. This is the actual truth.
40? Please, oh, okay. Get out of here.
Okay.
Get your nonsense. Why do you turn this podcast into a cathedral of lies?
Complimentary. Yes, everyone, I am 40 plus.
I'm 50.
Yes.
I will be for 9 years. I round up and then I wait till I get high enough to round again.
I hope you're all enjoying this banter, by the way.
Yeah, because the votes were in. We stick with the banter. It was one of those questions, Pav, that, you know, I didn't really need to be told again that we shouldn't have the banter. The banter stays.
The banter stays. Because, you know, it is actually, it's a great time for us to just connect as well. Because
you're so busy on the air fryer.
Everybody is very busy in their lives. And sometimes this is the intentional excuse, the intentional reason that we have to sort of connect about these silly things and be a little bit silly. Why not? It's a lot of fun. I love to hear other people being silly. And when you were talking about, you know, that connection between podcast and radio show, a lot of radio show hosts will record podcasts either after their radio show airs or just take their radio show and put it on as a podcast, because people really do enjoy listening to that back and forth. It's funny, it's entertaining, and it does feel like you were just right there. You get a little bit of insight into people's lives and you feel like you know them, you feel like you're friends with them. I enjoy it and I think that there's value to it. We don't always get that kind of time to decompress with our friends and chit chat about just everyday things and talk about the air fryer that we got for, you know, my birthday. How many times can you say that becomes a part of your conversation and you've intentionally made it part of the conversation and we had a few laughs about it. So why not? Yeah, it stays. The banter stays.
As you were talking, Pav, it reminded me, you know, as we've both shifted to new jobs, still mm-hmm. teaching, it takes on a different phase because we're in different grades, different spaces, different teachers. And we could never say they were our spaces. Although I think our own learning had sort of manifested that we didn't really own the spaces we were teaching in anyways.
Right.
And as you were talking, I was thinking about the last 2 weeks, lots of highs and lows, lots of emotions. And I was thinking what's been one of the best things was actually just a conversation I had with a teacher whose room I haven't been in, but we've passed a few times here or there. And it was just a 10-minute conversation in the hallway. And we were talking about pedagogy and, you know, trying to absorb as much knowledge as you could and understanding that there's tons of stuff out there, and just got a little bit of insights into what makes each other tick. Mm-hmm. And we started to talk about goal setting and how important it was for our students to have goals rooted in responsibility or rooted in something of value, and trying to make sure that we were opening up our students' self-awareness to set goals, to be proactive in their goal setting, to know what's out there, to know what they want to be. And it was like a meshing of the minds. And it was a great conversation, but it wasn't, you know, the principal providing release time to go and plan and talk. It wasn't a plan, I'll come into your room at 9:15 and we can do this. No, it was just organic conversation in the hallway at lunch. And I come back and said, in the last 2 weeks, not that I want to make a hierarchy of events, but it was certainly one of the real positive events that gave me a little bit of, you know, juice in this new role. Because, you know, as I joked last time, I'm one of those TikTok Mike Tysons. Like, I feel like I get punched in the face all the time. And so it's been picking and choosing the highs and the lows. But it's been very humbling, because I think I got so used to so many successes that I think I projected on other folks that maybe they were having as many successes. And so you should be able to do what I do without me saying you should do what I do.
Right.
Because I can bring this certain energy, or I'm invigorated by the energy around me. But maybe in the last, I don't know how many weeks I've been in this job, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, that energy's not as consistent. It's not as predictable.
Right.
And so it's tougher to go into work every day when you're not totally certain the type of energy and vibe and communication, conversation, and tasks you're going to do. Yeah. When those days are different all the time, there's a different vibe to going to build, the less predictability. So it's been a little eye-opening for me to maybe assume, although I don't think I ever outwardly said, you should be feeling the way I feel about teaching, but I think maybe my content, I didn't know enough about what other teachers are going through in other spaces to sort of get a sense of the highs and lows maybe they go through.
I think that's such an insightful anecdote that you have provided, Che, because when we have our own classroom spaces, our own, you know, space that we go into every day, there's a certain amount of consistency. And when you become an instructional leader, you become a coach, you become a student success teacher, a centrally assigned teacher, you don't have the luxury of that consistency. Everything, every day is going to be different. And I know that you and I have had these conversations because you and I are in the same role now. We've had these conversations daily, you know, where I say, you know, I really don't know what to expect from today. I don't think it's going to be a great day because of X, Y, and Z that happened last time I was, you know, here. I feel a little bit nervous. And then, you know, the day goes by and then we reconnect to talk about, you know, how the day went. And it's like, it was completely different from what I thought it was going to be. There were, you know, this many successes, and that sort of predictability that we have when we're in our own classroom spaces, it's not there anymore. And so when we can rely on, you know, I know the students in my space, I more or less know what things are going to be happening, and so I can prepare and plan for that. There's a little bit of comfort in having your own classroom space, you know, not that it belongs to us, but you see the same people every day, you have the same students, you have the same expectations of what more or less is going to happen throughout the school. And that consistency gives us a little bit of comfort because we know what to expect. And so that's something that I have really learned is, one, don't take it personally when things don't go your way, because there are a lot of different factors that are playing into what that day will be like. And so I'm glad to hear that you've had that sort of realization that it's different, and you can't really influence the way that the day is going to go so much, or depend on that consistency to sort of know what your day is going to be like. I think that's a pretty big revelation. And I think that you can really adjust how you approach the role based on just knowing that small fact. And so that's really helped me to not take the day so personally, and, you know, to sort of let go of a little bit of that control that you inherently have when it's your own classroom, your own space, the students that you see every single day. So that's my long-winded way of saying, don't worry about it. Don't worry, be happy.
Of course.
Yeah.
some good nuggets in there, Pav. You know, don't take it personally or don't get emotional. I still, I don't see a struggle with it, but, you know, struggle with it. Mm-hmm. if we've learned anything through sort of through all our social justice work, and not solely through social justice work, is the ability to honor emotion. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of rich to say, now, not that you use that word. You said, you didn't use the word emotion. You said responsibility. Or no, you didn't say responsibility. It wasn't my... Oh, you didn't say emotion. I made the connection to emotion. You just don't take it personally, you said. And then I sort of thought of emotion. I said, well, I want to honor the emotion. Now, I may not lash out with every emotion I have, but I don't want to just dismiss every emotion that comes with the job or anything per se. But I just start to drift a little bit into that space. It's like I understand what you're saying. There's so many other factors, and I think as human beings, we always simplify it, and we create probably erroneous steps or factors or levels of importance when there's so many things going on. You don't know what everyone's lived experiences or what they're going through on that daily basis to know what they're bringing to the table. So perhaps I have a negative interaction with a child. I know what you mean. Don't take it personally. It might not be what I've done or said, but that's where the student is at that moment. So you sort of, you take what they bring you. I remember actually an old principal said something to me that enlightened me years ago, that students bring the best they have every day.
Yeah.
And it may not be what we consider the best, whatever that might be, if you want to filter that through, but students are giving us our best, their best. And so how are we going to work with it? And you could put this into a sports analogy, but I won't. Well, I put it into a cooking analogy. Not
oh,
that I,
cooking.
Well, we're talking air fryers. Might as
not?
Well. You know, it's not every day do I have all the freshest ingredients in front of me and all the most expensive
That's right.
herbs. What can I whip up with three eggs and some old marble cheese that's got mold on it?
Oh, boy. You can cut that mold off in many cases and just still use the cheese.
But just fry it. Fry it. Air fry it. Cover it in eggs and fry it again. We'll try this after.
Okay.
During the break.
Sounds good.
We've been going a wild path. Let's get in. We should get into our anecdote.
Yeah.
But of course, we should talk about what we actually have coming up. And of course, by the time this episode is out, these events have already happened. So shame upon you for not registering when hearing about these in a few moments. Pav, let them know what we're up to, what we've been up to. It's sort of like a Back to the Future moment because we're recording this and we know we've got these events coming this week.
But
we're not releasing this episode until after those events have passed.
That's right. So it is going to be something that's in the past. Yes. Yeah, so we do have a couple of presentations, or we did have a couple of presentations.
It's eerie, eh?
It is. It's a little bit weird. So yes, we presented for Federation Day for ETT, Federation Elementary Teachers of Toronto, and as well as the ETFO, Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario, ICT conference. We talked about how to start a student-led podcast for both. And we hope that there were a lot of great moments.
It was a smashing success. Yes. You can tell by all the social media posts. We had a great time. And of course, Pat, if your school, if your board is interested in podcasting, like, we don't just fool around and talk about air fryers. We can bring some quality PD to your space when talking about student advocating, elevating student voice, and podcasting. So you can always reach out to us that way. How about a commercial, come back with an anecdote, and get into our episode?
I think that's a great idea.
Because we are once, twice, 119 times a podcaster. And you're listening to The Chay and Pav Show. And we are glad you are back. Let's get into the anecdote quickly, Pav.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can get into our conversation. I like our conversation today because it reminds me of sort of our first 20, 25 episodes where it wasn't so much research-based. It's just sort of about our observations, things we have done, and we were inspired to talk about it,
mm-hmm.
which is probably why we're recording now and not releasing it almost right away because we just released a wonderful episode.
That's right.
But with our new jobs comes a lot of professional development.
Yes.
And we are gifted development that not all teachers are gifted. And you and I have worked this out. Like, this is, how do you get rich, meaningful development to teachers? Because you can't rely on staff meetings and after school. So we sort of know our positionality that we're being gifted unbelievable amounts of professional mm-hmm. development. And then how can we find creative and innovative and inspiring ways to bring it into the spaces we're around? And so You know, there's many ways to document your learning, and we're always taking notes here or there, or chit-chatting with each other, or commenting with people beside you. And then there was a break, and you and I were going through our notebooks, and Shauna came over to us, you know, the illustrator of the picture book, The Magnificent Microphone. Mm-hmm. She's also in this crew of teachers. She said, "What are you guys, what are you writing down? You're taking notes, taking notes?" I said, No. I am now jotting down as many different podcast topics as I can based on the 45 minutes. And you and I were just flowing. Let's talk about this. Yeah. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about this. And the word that had come up is performative.
Yeah.
Performance. And you and I started to think about this a little bit because I think I went on like a little mini chant. I said, the act of calling things out as performative is becoming nothing more than performative. Mm. It's a dance. And I don't know what I'm more angry at. Oh, that wasn't really angry. I'm just, you know, posturing. I'm getting almost more frustrated with people dedicating all their time to trying to announce things as performative because I think it's now performative. Now I'm starting to think, is this just virtue signaling? And we were having this conversation.
Right.
And then I said, then we flipped it around. I was like, is there actually a place for the performative in how we build up doing the work? Because the work we know is important and we all come at it from different lived experiences and our role within that, although it's shared in many ways, but it's different in many ways as well. And so we started to think about how are we moving teachers to the work? And is performative part of that?
Mm-hmm.
And it's rather than necessarily, and this is sort of our conversation path, rather than scaring people off immediately by thinking if they do something that someone's going to, as fast as they can, scream as loud as they can that something's performative, and in fact alienating that teacher and almost assuring they're not going to do anything more, perhaps we should take on, if we think that we have this great insight to see everything as performative, perhaps we shouldn't invest our time in calling things out as performative, because now I want to know why am I doing it? Am I doing it to show to everyone that I can see something as performative, or am I doing it to actually try to help someone grow? And my observations is that most people, maybe myself included, or I guess I'll say myself, is that we get into this act of calling people out, and I think it becomes a little bit more of virtue signaling. I want everyone to know that I saw something as performative, but am I going to gift and give the necessary time and requirements and support that I am telling you, if I'm going to call you out or call you in or whatever you want to call it, is performative, you better be committed to more work than just that. That's not the work, in my opinion. Well, it's not the work to call someone out as performative. If you feel someone's doing something performative, which is hurtful, then you are committing yourself to support, mentoring, resources, checking in again, having conversation, bouncing ideas. But if you think your work is simply calling something that was performative, well, then for me, that's performative.
Wow. Yeah, Che. That's very powerful. And that, what a great way to start this conversation. This idea of the work being performative and how it deters people from starting doing the work, because there's this fear that it will just come across as being performative when they do it. It has me thinking about what makes work or anything performative, right? What makes it a performance? So we're doing it as a show. We're doing it to show off that we are doing something when in fact it may not be something that is sincere or intentional or authentic to the community that we have in front of us. So we're showing off, we're doing something for others to see that we're doing it. So we might be doing this work for somebody else, right? Somebody else asked us to do it. So I'm thinking about maybe an administration saying, we've got a list of things that we have to do. I need to check off the things that we're doing, all of these things. So can we please do these things? Right. So that is something when I think about performative, I think that's what it is. We're checking things off of a list. There's a certain expectations that are put out in front of us and we need to comply, right? We need to comply with these expectations. And so that is something that makes it performative, or even something like mimicry, right? The teacher next door is doing this thing. Maybe they are contributing to the assembly and you think, well, I want to look just as good as that teacher. And maybe I'm going to mimic that teacher and I'm going to do the same thing or something similar or something that gets me the same amount of attention. And I think that the point that we want to get to here is, yes, and you talked about so much about helping people grow and that virtue signaling of you know, constantly calling people out or in on the work that they are doing as being performative. But also, I think that what we have come to realize, and maybe in our own experience, our own lived experience, our own teaching experience, sometimes that performative action that we take with the work that we do in terms of social justice work can actually lead to our own growth or lead to the growth of the students that we have in front of us. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes it may not be such a bad idea to engage in some performative work. Like, if there is some benefit from it, if maybe something sticks, you know, you see a positive outcome with the students that you are working with or with the teachers that you are working with, then was it really performative? Maybe the intention was performance, but the outcome may not be as such. And so is it still performative if there is a positive outcome?
That's a clever spin on that. I you caught me at embrace that perhaps these performative. Now I say performative in question marks, because what is performative? Who's stating something is performative? And I got to sort of weave back on my own thoughts. Nothing we do is neutral. And so sometimes I think we get caught in, maybe it's not social justice work, any type of work. I think, it's adding on. Maybe it's not great work, but it's an add-on. It can only help. But that's not actually true. Some stuff can actually hurt. Mm-hmm. And so I think when we're diving into this idea of performative is something like the Pink Shirt Day. Yes. Maybe it's seen as performative, but you know, who's measuring that? Who's collecting data? And how many folks started sort of their anti-bullying crusades, their building up of real empathy, really taking further steps in the school? Did they start with the more nuanced, entrenched steps, or did they maybe they start with the pink shirt, and it opened their eyes? We always talk about these co-learning, that as teachers, we're learning in the spaces together as well. Well, part of this performance is also us diving into new content area. I bring a lot of this stuff back to classroom teaching. And what are good practices in teaching? Well, good practices in teaching are scaffolding and modeling and having access points and a variety of access points. And building some flow and building capacity. And one could probably argue that in teaching, as we build capacities, it's about all those great components of teaching. And so when I think of what is considered performative gesturing, performative gestures of, I gave the Pink Shirt Day as one in particular, that if, are we sticking around to watch to see if the act really was performance, which was your Annette, or are we monitoring to see if this leads to folks further embracing the content and taking the ownership to do a little bit more, to learn a little bit more, that all of a sudden if they go into their math space, all of a sudden they're a little bit more aware of how a student may be bullied in a math space where maybe they weren't as aware before, and the pink shirt became an access point. And so this concept, this conversation we have is like, is there a place to embrace performative, I put in quotation marks, performative work, because it provides the scaffolding that some folks are going to need to get into this space and to start doing the work. I think of, I remove again the social justice component, I talk about poetry.
Yeah.
And I think of the very superficial performative poetry I would have done in my class in year 5,
yeah,
year 6, year 7. But those pieces, as I got a little bit more, as I saw student success with them,
yes,
I said, oh, I could try this next. I could do this next. And collectively, maybe not each, maybe the class I had in year 7, we didn't grow. We grew. But in regards to poetry, I got an idea by how they engaged in that poetry for how I would set it up in grade 8, how I'd set up in grade 9. And I know in like year 15, 16, 17, 18, 19 in my class that poetry became foundational, woven through everything, but it wasn't beforehand. Yeah. But my poetry that I would have started with would have been, I would have deemed, performative poetry, performance, one-offs, simplistic, no depth of understanding. Yet it was those first steps for me as a teacher in seeing those student successes, the cross interaction between us, the collective growth, that all of a sudden my poetry, I would never say I'm a great poetry teacher or have a great poetry program, but I know poetry is woven throughout almost everything I do.
So here's why I think that that worked. You as a teacher looked at the data, right? You looked at your data. You looked at the student success. You looked at the stories. You saw how students were responsive to the poetry, that performative, you called it, I'm putting it in quotation marks, you called it performative poetry that you were doing in your spaces. You looked at that data that was impacting the students with that poetry. And in your, you've said this in the early episodes that we talked about, you know, there were some areas of the curriculum that you didn't feel as strong. So you were much more intentional about making those areas of your teaching stronger. You were intent on improving those areas. So you saw where maybe there were some holes in your pedagogy, and you were able to fill those holes with your own personal growth. Now, I would hope that most teachers that are, you know, teaching in the practice of teaching are taking a look at their data year after year. And, you know, student stories, the successes that we see, our own pedagogical documentation is data, right? We're looking at that year after year or even throughout the year to see what is working and what is not working and where students are responding. And we're building upon that. And so we looked at that data. You looked at that data and you improved your poetry to so much so that it is now woven into, as you say, every part of the curriculum because it was impactful. It was important. It was important to you. It was important to the students. And so you can't really say at that point that any of it was performative, right? Because even that initial poetry that you thought was being done as an add-on, you were using it intentionally. So was it really performative? Now, you touched on something earlier on to say that, you know, nothing we do as teachers is neutral, that it can be harmful. There is potential for harmful. So what I'm thinking about is, when does it become harmful? Because at some point, that performative thing, the reason that it's always being called out or that many people do call out some things as being performative is because it is harmful. So at what point does the performance, whether it's in the curriculum or whether it's the social justice work that we are doing in our classroom spaces, when does it become harmful and how do we prevent that? I'm throwing that out there as, you know, you don't have to answer this. Maybe this is something that we can talk about. But if you've got an answer, I want to hear it.
Oh, you want to know what I've done?
Yes.
As you were talking about that, I started to think about some of the Indigenous art assignments I had used in my class as I started to become more aware of how the Indigenous story was erased from every component of my classroom. Willfully, unwillfully, I probably couldn't even articulate it, but I could disrupt and go through the data of my teachings to say I didn't have any. And so as I maybe rushed too fast to embed, I would do art activities like dream catchers that are purely performative. And then I look and I cringe that I did them, but that was my first step. And so when you talked about how am I hurting with our conversation with Kalinda Klein, I don't even know if she used that explicit word, but that's just how I felt when she spoke, is that this is potentially traumatizing. This is hurtful to trivialize something like this or to make this the root of all your Indigenous work, which again, so it could be performative. So what did you do with that? And so I don't do that activity anymore. I try to go a little bit more nuanced, more detail, more authentic voices. Going into workshops, hearing Indigenous authors. You know, our blockout poetry was one, weaving poetry in our Indigenous studies. And so I know I've become much more purposeful. So was it hurtful? It might have been hurtful. And so you ask a great question, like, and this is where it does become difficult, because you know we've done some work on anti-racism and people say you got to do the work because you won't get it perfect, so you've got to do the work. But do you have to build up a certain level of competency before you start? Not that you need to be an expert, and so that's sort of something I'm grappling with, and this is why in the social justice movement, and Pav, you know, our studies have led us there. And I'll speak for me. I know I've learned a lot from you. I've learned a lot from teaching in Rexdale. Mm-hmm. But for me, I'm not comfortable even asserting that I'm a social justice warrior. Not because I'm not committed to the work and wanting to learn and wanting to grow. And I think my classroom is a really good mentor text for what a white male can do in a racialized community. Not because it's perfect, because it's sort of imperfect, but it's committed to the task. Mm-hmm. And am I aware that I might be hurtful? I am aware. So I try to do common sense. Now, that's tough to gauge and that's tough to monitor.
Yeah.
But at least in the spaces, I'm aware of how I can be hurtful with the words I use, the examples I choose, the trivial tasks. But I think this also comes down to class culture. And as the class culture, if you speak openly on social justice throughout all content, all the mm-hmm. time, not just as a Thursday morning courageous conversation activity that sort of seems in a silo, students become more open to the idea that you're learning too, but they know that you're committed to it. And so there becomes a grace in the space. And so I think what I saw the most, and again, this is data. This is not, it's not just because it's not EQAO doesn't mean it's not data. What I saw in students is that they saw in me a commitment to social justice on a variety of, whether it be indigenous issues, LGBTQ, that they saw I would be an advocate, an ally. I was doing my best. I was putting it out there in public. I was sharing the learning I was doing, the books I was reading, and it didn't make me perfect, but I think it opened up the space to my teachers committed. And so the trauma I could have induced or was potentially inducing through the tasks, I think becomes maybe less so. I don't definitively know, because students knew what my, again, intent isn't the issue, right? But I think in a classroom, students do, it is important to them to know what your intent is. Mm-hmm. And so although I've had a great 21 years of teaching, I've also been really open with people that I get away with my mistakes. And I get away with my mistakes, maybe because I'm white, maybe because I'm male, maybe because I'm privileged, but it's also because I'm really competent. It's also because I really care about my job. And it's also because I commit tons and tons of hours and extracurricular hours. And so you've earned a little bit of that grace. And I think on my journey of this work, I think my students have gifted me the space to get better. Because when maybe they could have burned me down for saying something inappropriate, not that I was trying to say something inappropriate, something hurtful, they could see that I was on a journey, and on a journey for the right reasons. And we sort of all collectively knew that the classroom was better for it.
Yeah.
And so it comes back down to those roots of class culture. So that's a really long-winded question. No, it's
an
a long-winded
answer
to your question.
To my long-winded question. Yes, fair enough. You said a lot of really great things. I took a bunch of notes. I circled a bunch of things. I highlighted a bunch of things. I think the most important thing that you said is that you want to approach anything that you do as a teacher with a level of authenticity, honesty, and transparency, because ultimately it boils down to the relationships that you create with your students through the content that you are teaching. And so if students can see that you are being introspective, that you are constantly disrupting and self-interrogating, and you are making a conscious effort to decenter yourself in that classroom space as, you know, someone who is not the be-all and the end-all of the space, not the, you know, the higher power, the voice of the classroom, that everybody has equal voice in that learning space, and you are simply there to facilitate whatever learning is happening that day, then your impact is going to be great regardless of the intent, right? Like that your intent, of course, intent matters. And I think that is an important point that we are making, that impact versus intent, right? So your intentions, regardless of performative or not performative, as a teacher, I hope that your intentions are good. But the impact of your intentions is going to differ based on the work that you're doing and whether or not you are self-interrogating and disrupting yourself and constantly thinking about the work that you are doing in your space. You wanted to say something.
I'm thinking of bank finances, because I'm thinking, yes, my money's growing, but it grows on the week, but not every day does it grow.
Right.
And so do we derail our growth when we have individual moments that don't go well because we zoom in so close on them, we now don't see them in the full package. And so this becomes sort of the when you talk about, you know, intent matters, but also intent doesn't matter. It's about impact. But but if we're open with what we're intending to do and we built that culture, then all of a sudden it is important.
It is important. That's right. So when is it most harmful? It's most harmful when there is no quest for more knowledge and when there is no quest for more growth. That's when it's harmful.
Can I come to you on this one? Because I've got a couple of notes here.
Sure.
Because it's commitment to improvement.
Yes,
when teachers are committed to improvement. So how do we inspire people to be committed to their improvement? And this comes to, you know, something else I find very performative. And maybe what we're finding in this conversation is that what is performative is individualized.
Mm.
That what is performative to you is not performative to me. And so when we throw around terms like good, performative has become almost like one of those words. It holds a different meaning for everyone and almost has no value now for anybody as a collective to have a shared understanding. Because I think of this word of get uncomfortable. And you know, Pav, I've probably ranted on this a few times. I actually don't believe that. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe it solely for my own personal growth. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean I hope I'm not trying to project on people, but maybe I'm trying to share is that I find that statement to be performative because I come back to this commitment to improvement. How do I inspire teachers to improve? Get uncomfortable has turned so performative that people chase it.
Mm-hmm.
And people think that they're creating great sweeping change if they can make people feel uncomfortable. And I don't believe that.
Mm-hmm.
I actually believe that making you, and Pat, you've talked about this, making someone uncomfortable does one thing. It makes them uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's a lot of data to suggest that when most people get uncomfortable, they get better.
Right.
If there's not a whole bunch of other pieces that go with it, all you've done is make someone
push
uncomfortable.
Them away.
And, you know, we've done some work on one of the great PD sessions we had was, you know, the trauma-informed teaching.
Yes.
And it was about the science of the brain. And when the brain gets in a space it doesn't feel comfortable in, feels threatened by, feels traumatized by, it goes into survival mode.
That's right.
And so the literature is beyond reproach. You're not learning in that space. You're not growing in that space. You're in survival mode. So how come we chase getting uncomfortable as a means to learning when inherently, if we think this through, we actually know you don't learn in that space.
Right.
Again, it comes back to calling in, calling out. If you want to force people to get uncomfortable, it comes with the commitment that you're going to offer all the scaffolding. And then this comes back to me again, comes back to great teaching pedagogies. As a teacher, I never strive to make my students uncomfortable. And if they're uncomfortable, I'm not leaving them on their own to figure it out.
That's right.
And I certainly don't think, we talk about math, we think we make students uncomfortable with math, they're going to become we're going to build their math capacity. In fact, I think we already know this to be not the truth.
But this is the piece. This is the piece. When it comes to math, we want the struggle. We want the struggle to be productive. So when it comes to all of the work that we are doing in our spaces, you know, when does it become performative? When there's no growth involved. But how do we push someone to grow if they don't want to grow? We have to help them do it.
Yes.
And when you get them uncomfortable, when somebody is uncomfortable, you guide them through that work. You support them. You provide them with the care. You provide them with the care that is necessary for that growth. Because if I think about my own children, right, my own child is you know, upset about something, is not in a learning brain mode, is in a survival brain mode. It is my responsibility as the person who is responsible for this child to get them into a zone where they can go back into learning mode. So I have to provide the care and the support for my child to be able to do that.
So how often is that being done when people are professing you got to get uncomfortable?
Yeah,
or have they convinced
right.
themselves that I've done the teaching because I made you uncomfortable, which is why I use the expression, I'm chasing uncomfortableness.
That's right.
There's a rush to make everyone uncomfortable because they feel that's the magic formula to learning, but it's not.
Right.
It is a potential opportunity to learn.
That's right.
But it requires a lot of work. And so if you want to chase to make people uncomfortable, it comes with the moral and ethical responsibility that you're committed to their growth beyond just that moment, because if that's the moment you're patting yourself on the shoulder for the work, then for me that's
not it.
No, that's
performative. Right. You found the perfect opportunity to call somebody out so that you can appear to be the most knowledgeable in a particular space. But what work did you do to then, you know, to help that person that you have just called out grow? Because, or did you leave it at that?
Because you want the teacher to grow, right? You don't just want to look like you don't want to be the person in the group of 30 that in that situation, you just wanted to look like the person that was calling someone out for the 30 around, but you weren't committed to the work that goes with it. Mm-hmm. And so the calling out to make someone uncomfortable, this is about uncomfortable, it comes with work. So it comes back to my original statement, is making people uncomfortable the best way to make teachers grow? I actually don't think it is. I think it's about inspiration. It's about stories. It's about inspiring. It's about giving teachers access to PD. My commitment... Again, I don't put myself on any mantle for being a social justice warrior. I haven't done the work long enough. But it wasn't a level of uncomfortableness that put me in this space. Mm-hmm. It was inspiration. It was looking at my students. It was hearing their stories. It was giving great resources. It was about people, like, use an example like Kalinda Klein coming in and just sharing her passion, sharing her lived experience. And you just felt that you had to do more. You were inspired to do more and being gifted the time. Now, we know a lot of that learning for us, we had to do it ourselves. So what is our system doing to give teachers these inspirational moments that makes them morally and ethically driven to better their practice? Because I think it's really simple to say, let's get uncomfortable. Let's try to make someone uncomfortable. Because then in the one or two people that will do it, it's one or two people will self-profess this was the difference. But the majority have not. Mm-hmm. And so this reminds me to some of the things I did poorly as a teacher early on. I would base my teaching based on the two or three outlier performances that made my teaching look good and forget the masses. And I think I find the uncomfy chases the home run. And it doesn't chase the single. I want everyone in my lineup. Sports metaphor. I want everyone in my lineup to get single. Not one guy to hit a grand slam. Mm-hmm. I want everyone to be able to hit. Try to decipher the meaning of that.
I'm trying to turn it into a air fryer analogy, you just said.
We're almost ready for a commercial.
I think we are. I think we might be. I think we need a moment to just process everything and then possibly even come back for a swag bag after this.
Because it's been a good conversation.
Yeah.
Unscripted.
Just
a lot like our original episodes. Yes. We didn't spend as much time preparing. Not that I said we didn't prepare. Don't be that the only nugget you take from this episode. They don't prepare. I caught them.
I've enjoyed this conversation and the direction that it's taken. So let's take a break and then we'll come back.
We'll be right back.
Hello world, Brian Aspinall from Codebreaker EDU, and you are listening to the Che and Pab Show.
That's right. Come down to that. Uh-huh. That's right.
And this episode is brought to you by Ninja Air Fryers.
Yes.
The best way to make cheesecake. And what teacher doesn't like cheesecake?
I've never made a cheesecake in there.
You got something to do after this episode then.
I guess so.
This episode is also brought to you by Che and Pav, soon to be the sponsors of a slow pitch team. And also the authors of The Magnificent Microphone, podcast presenters. And of course, if you really want to get the nitty gritty, go to cheandpav.com, subscribe, and get our, I almost said weekly newsletter, Pav. That'd be a lot of pressure, eh? Our monthly newsletter that Che and Pav write and put together, which I really just mean Pav writes and puts together because she's brilliant in those spaces. And I'm like, huh? Newsletter? But I think you'd really enjoy that space. And we would really enjoy if you connected that way, because if Twitter were to implode tomorrow, it's our only way to stay connected. And we'll be right back with the swag bag.
And you're listening to the Che and Pav Show.
A cheesecake was so good.
It's lies. I never made one. I don't know how to make a cheesecake in an air fryer.
This reminds me of the book Rebound that I'm going to read. I just fed you the perfect lie All you had to do was take it. All you had to do was say, yes, I know.
That is.
And everyone would have believed that we could make cheesecake in the air fryer. But instead, you passed.
I chose to be honest and authentic and transparent with my audience, Che. What can you say?
Well, I said you made a great cheesecake. That's what I said.
I have cheesecake in the fridge, but I bought it from the store.
I know.
That's dessert.
Dude, this episode's over because we're recording live from our kitchen table.
That's right.
With two empty chairs. So, hey, first two people, you're in. And there's cheesecake for you.
Only two slices, though.
Pap, this has been a great episode. At least I think. Maybe not held by the majority. I have to get some more data on that. Because, for one, it reminds me of our roots. It's just, it was, we had one little blurb in our notebook. What is performative? And this is the 50 minutes of our episode. Mm-hmm. Probably only 30 minutes because the first 17 minutes is, you know, banter. But we're not cutting the banter. But where does it leave us? With no definitive answers.
Yeah.
Some thoughts. Some ideas. Spaces for other folks to join in and share.
Yeah.
What are their experiences? Like, I'll refresh my positionality. 21 years. White, male, teaching in a racialized community. Moving on to a central teaching job has put me in a bunch of different spaces, talking with a bunch of other different teachers. I don't necessarily know what's right. My experiences are based on my experiences. And as much as I speak loudly, it's not to project on you, but maybe it opens up the room for dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that that's the most important part here is because Che and I, you know, although we come at this with very, very different lived experiences, different lives, we didn't come to any sort of answer here. And I'm actually very curious to know what people think about this and how you feel about it, you know, because I'm thinking about the individual versus the community when we're doing this work in our classrooms, when it comes to social justice work, or even just improving our pedagogy in the classroom. There's this real, and I used to think this way as well, that it's a very individualized experience. I can say that I myself became motivated because of the podcast or because of being gifted particular professional developments, and it moved me. And as an individual, I made the decision to gain some more insight, to gain more knowledge, to improve my practice. But how are we doing that as a community? How are we encouraging our peers, our colleagues to also encounter or engage in some growth? Or is it even our place to do that? You know, how do we do this work collectively without it becoming performative? And so that is a question that I continue to grapple with. And I didn't give it a lot of thought. I used to think of it as this is my journey. This is the work that I am doing. I am a better teacher because of the work that I did to improve myself. But now where is my responsibility to make this part of community-driven work or collaborative work? Do I have that responsibility? And who gave me that responsibility? Did I give myself that responsibility? Or is that something that I just have to grow into as part of the journey into doing this work? And so that's something that I continue to grapple with. And I don't know if there's an answer to that. I don't know if somebody can give me some more insights, give me something to read, give me something to listen to make me feel like I'm going in the right direction with this.
Pav, you said a lot of great things. And what resonated with me, firstly, was the idea that you've got to take care of yourself first. You got to know yourself, self-actualize. And we know we can't ever really know ourselves. But before we can start impacting the community, or maybe before we should even try to start impacting the community, we need to have impacted ourselves. Mm-hmm. And this comes back to actually sort of the theme of this episode that maybe has been lost a little bit, is that I think we're trying to position that perhaps performative is a space where we as individuals start.
Mm.
And so our growth comes from a little taste of knowledge, a little taste of success. And so when we bring perhaps these performative gestures into our room, like the pink shirt day or the orange shirt day, it becomes an access point, a window mm-hmm. to wanting to do a little bit more. And maybe it's you and the students collectively growing together. And so this act of performance, which I think what we've done in this episode is really opened up what the working definition of performance is, because I think it's going to be different for everyone, is that perhaps our performance, being aware of trauma that it can induce and not to just say, go for it anyways, like recklessly, but also being aware that that performative acts, and that even for our students, it may be first access points for them.
Right.
Maybe the orange shirt is the starting point they need. And so rather than turning it into a moment where you can call everyone else out for their performative actions on wearing an orange shirt, you can take that moment to maybe help bridge or spur on the community to do more.
That's right.
Like, so then it becomes, so then the folks, this is where calling out people as performative becomes performative, because are you really doing the work? Mm-hmm. When ultimately we can maybe say, this is the gifted opportunity to inspire for more action. And when you turn it into a negative,
yeah,
and put people in a place that maybe they're afraid to do it now because they're afraid to be called out because someone's insisting that they need to be uncomfortable to learn. Perhaps uncomfortable, as I said earlier, is not the first thing to chase for growth. Mm-hmm. And we know it's part of that growth, not for everyone. We know it's a component. We know it's differentiated. It's in there, but it comes with commitment to those that are making those uncomfortable. I think that's the moral responsibility you take.
Yeah.
If you've convinced yourself that it's uncomfortableness that's going to be the growing factor. But you know, Pav, you and I have always fixated on, and you talked about that brilliantly. You put it nice and linearly. Not that everything has to be linear. Find yourself, build yourself, grow yourself. And once you have, take on that responsible, that level of responsibility. Say, now, how can I impact community, whether it's your hallway, mm-hmm. whether it's the community you're teaching in, whether it's the learning network you're teaching in. Mm-hmm. So I love that you brought that back to that. And then I just wanted to sort of remind folks that I think we're trying to find, where does performative play into growth? Because I think it's really simplistic to say the performative hurts. And I'm not saying it doesn't. I'm not just trying to extract a little bit more from this. Because when we turn things, everything into simplified explanations that performative is solely traumatizing, then we're not engaging in perceived performative things. And then are we growing at all?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's something to be, everything is complex, nuanced. And I think that this is what we're trying to get to. Pav, why don't you, a couple of comments and we'll wrap this up with a swag bag. Not that I have anything yet.
I don't have anything further to add, except for one thing. I think that I will add this one thing that we have to also consider. We have to consider rest. I think we have to consider rest, because a lot of people are doing this work. A lot of people are out there doing this work and have been doing this work and are exhausted from this work. And I think that we have to take time to rest ourselves, and also allow people an opportunity to rest, because in that rest comes reflection, it comes further growth, it comes the processing happens during that time. And so I think that, you know, the social justice movement is very, very exhausting in the sense that there are a lot of emotional burdens that people put on themselves when they are doing this work. And it's not easy to call things out and then also provide the supports that are needed for that person to grow, because there are a lot of emotions that are tied into that experience. And so I just want to leave that, because I don't want to leave that piece unsaid. I think it's also very important. And we may not go into it as much today because there's so much research, there's so much data surrounding the importance of rest when it comes to this work, that perhaps that's something that we can explore at a different time. But I also want to put out there in this episode, because it is heavy content, that rest is extremely, extremely important, and it shouldn't be ignored.
No, Pav, that was so well said, because I don't think we'd really address that at all. That who are we putting the emotional burden on to mm-hmm. teach us all, to inspire us all, and how disproportionate is it? And who are the same folks? And then it does become a nuanced conversation, because you have to find sort of that sweet bliss, because at some point in my journey, I don't know enough and I can't find the resource. I can't look up. I haven't found the story. I haven't found the clip, but I've invested the energies to try to. But at some point, I do need that expert lived experience. But you can't rush to that voice when you haven't put in the work yourself.
Right.
But how do we demonstrate that we've done that work? Because it's tough. No one has almost any idea the depth to what people are doing. And so it becomes difficult to negotiate. So I'm glad you just brought that theme up on completely, even, and then coupled that with the rest, that there are definitely folks that are being asked all the time, and perhaps they feel they just need to make people uncomfortable because that's where they're at in their journey.
That's right.
Because they've gone through so many things where they haven't seen the outcomes they want to see.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I think this comes back to something you talked about. This is really a very personal journey, and we can't know what everyone is going through. And I think almost with performative, that's what we're getting to, is that performative and performance is a very individualized take on the word. And it becomes complex into how does performative action hurt or help the work?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess for each individual, it can do one or the other.
That's right.
Not to make everything a binary relationship.
Right. It really is on a spectrum.
All right, Pav.
A little bit of swag bag now?
Yeah, this episode was done in 22 minutes. I told you we'd be fast.
You know what? I really, really valued this conversation because I think these are things that have been brewing in us for some time now. And I think we really needed this hour to hash it out and really, really talk about the things that we've had on our mind with this sort of intent and purpose. And so...
No answers per se.
No.
We've ascended to no mountaintop.
But I think that what we did was articulate things that were on our mind after we had processed them a little bit further. And I think that the conversation was really beneficial.
I think we went beyond the simplistic, beyond the binary, and highlighted some of the complexities and nuances. And they contrast each other. And they contradict each other. So how do we negotiate that? Because I could probably tell you a lot of the things we said were true, but they conflict each other. They don't actually, so two things can be true that actually don't necessarily go together in one context, but that's what I thought with this conversation. It was nuanced, it's complex, it's contrasting, and they conflict.
Yeah.
So.
That's perfect.
This is why the work is hard.
This is why the work is hard. And I think this is why these conversations that we have with one another work, because we're able to talk about this.
Teachers talking. Teaching. Mm-hmm. We grow together. It's collective and it's collaborative.
Exactly.
We'll see you next time on episode 120 of the Air Fryer Show with Jay and Pat.
I like that.
Sponsorship dollars are starting to flow in.
Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Take care.